You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 449. Do or do not. There is no try. Yoda, Jedi Master.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Today on the show, guys, we have returning champion Ben Yenny. Now, Ben is a film distribution expert and has been on the show multiple times talking about film distribution, one of my favorite subjects. Now, in this episode, we're going to talk about what is going on currently from his point of view in the film distribution game with COVID and what's going on. And he just opened up his own distribution company and is doing some really cool things with that. So we wanted to dig into what it's like right now on the street during these turbulent times in film distribution. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Ben Yenny. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion Ben Yenny. How are you doing, Ben?
Very well, Alex. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. As I think this is your third time.
Yep,
third time, right? Three. But you have the distinct honor of being my very first interview ever on Indie Film Hustle. Not the first release, but I think you were the first interview I ever did, if I remember correctly.
I think I might have been the third, but I was the first that wasn't your own personal friend.
I think it's something like that. I remember you're one of the first two or three that got released. So you humbled me by coming onto my little podcast all those years ago. And now we're over 400 episodes and it's gotten insane.
It's been
kind of crazy, but you've been busy as well. For everybody listening, Ben is an amazing sales rep, but has since jumped over to the good side of the force. It all depends on how you look at it, and became a full blown distributor, which we're going to get into as well. But I wanted to bring you back on the show, man, to talk about it's the insane times we're living in, and how they're affecting our business. So, how has COVID affected film sales from your point of view, domestically and internationally?
It's a weird mix for COVID. It's much more affordable to be starting a sales and distribution company because we don't have to worry about market fees, which also means that we don't claim them as recoups, but we don't have to worry about actually traveling to Berlin and France and even LA for me now. We just jump on Zoom calls a lot. And beyond that, we've also been able to get a lot of development executives on the phone a lot more easily than we think we would have. Although, on the same note, we had a big pitch at one of the big kids TV channels the day that everything shut down in LA in March. And if that had gone differently, I think they would have bought that film, which ended up not happening. But
of course, because the entire world went upside down at that moment.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. So that was that was less than ideal, but we're still in talks with a lot of people about that. Just takes longer than we would have expected.
So the thing is that's one area that I've always had to. I had a real big sticking point is those fees, those market fees that you need to recoup as a distributor. And they're still charging them now, even though there are no market fees, arguably. I mean, AFM cost what this year to go in virtually? It didn't cost much at all, did it?
I think we had both a booth and everyone on my team had buyer badges because they were completely free. The booth was something like $500 or $600. Right. And we got a bit of our total cost was right around $900, and we included a bit of MailChimp subscription in that too.
Right. So let's say $1,000. Let's say $1,000 total.
Yeah.
Which is generally a price of doing business as a distributor. You generally wouldn't pass that on to your filmmakers. But before, how much did it cost to go to AFM?
I've had booths before. The very cheap end of it is $3,500, which is just for the booth. That's not including any advertising.
Or travel or food or if you bring somebody else and all that stuff. So it could go up to comfortably $5,000 to $10,000. And if you get bigger booths, it could go up to $50,000 or $100,000.
Oh, easily, yeah. It is much more affordable to get started now. But I'm sure you know on this front, because it's something that you've talked about on both in your book and a lot of podcasts, that the floor for when it's that cheap to get started, the competition becomes really intense really quickly if you don't know what you're doing with it. And so it's a bit of a double-edged sword.
So right now, that's another thing you're seeing. You're seeing a lot of distributing startups coming up really quickly now. As before, it's like any part of our business. Like before, it used to be $100,000 to $200,000 for a camera. And now you can make a film with, you know, for under $5,000 comfortably with a, you know, a beautiful 4K image on a Blackmagic, let's say, or even on a Red, some of the smaller Reds you can go for under $10,000. So it now allows a lot of people to get into the business, but now the competition becomes a lot more. So the same problem that filmmakers are having with distributors are having with themselves.
A little bit. Yeah. It's it's not as much of a problem because so much of being successful in this business is based on relationships and long-standing relationships. And those aren't something that really ever had a dollar value attached to them, except that you had to pay to travel to these places. So it's the biggest thing I actually worry about for the long-term health of the industry as it stands right now is finding a good entry point for the bigger platforms. And if markets like AFM have a big sea change in them, I worry about where you could actually go to start to come up if you haven't done anything yet.
Meaning as a distributor?
As a distributor or a filmmaker, frankly. I started going to AFM as a filmmaker and then became a producer's rep, and then now I'm a distributor and something of a sales agent too. But we just got a partner on that to take some of that off my shoulders because I was doing too much. Yeah, I don't think that the biggest thing about becoming a successful filmmaker is hitting the point where you're actually broken enough that you can get attention and get an agent if you want to go the studio route, as opposed to the more filmtrepreneur route, which I know you advocate and I do too. And I don't know what the path for that would be now that there isn't something like the AFM where you can actually meet people who can get your film on Showtime, or if you're a distributor, you can find those, you can establish those relationships with those buyers so you can be that junction point.
I understand, because I've been to AFM a bunch of times, and I get that. Like, you just run into people, you have dinners, you meet people at parties, you make those relationships, you start, you know, you start building rapport, and that takes time, it takes years. Like, I think originally when we first started talking years ago, you were telling me that, like, when you show up to AFM, no one's really going to do business, real business with you for a few years until they realize, like, oh, this guy's still showing up, he's not fly by night, and it, you know, takes those years of time, where now that avenue, at least as of this recording, is not there. I mean I had Jonathan Wolf on the other day on the show as well to talk about the future of it, of AFM and markets in general. I mean, I think personally, I think they will come back in one way, shape, or form, but they were hurting prior to COVID. They were hurting prior to COVID, so I'm not sure how you and I knew. I don't think we're going to go back there. Do you agree?
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think that it's going to ever be what it was, but I mean, all of the old timers I know in the business have been saying it's not what it was since I started going. And I mean, like, the apparently during like the 80s and early 90s, it was basically printing money, because if you had access to a VHS player, you could just hand over fist, man. I mean, and then DVD, everything became much less expensive, but people were still making so much money on physical media that it was a great time to be in sales and distribution. And then when the bottom fell out after 2008, it's been a lot rougher since then. And I'm sure you know this too. This is something that I believe I've heard on your podcast once or twice. I do still actually listen to your podcast.
And I appreciate that, sir. Thank you. Agreed. I always tell people there is still a place for physical media, no question.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not what it was, and it's niche. It's much, much more niche for physical media. And I think overseas, there's still physical media is still somewhat of a thing, or is it not? I'm not sure how much physical media is overseas anymore.
Depends on the territory more than anything. Like the territories that are more technologically repressed, there's still a little bit of it, except there's a really interesting story in Africa as a territory in that they just kind of skipped televisions altogether. So they're straight on mobile and VOD. They just skipped physical media for a lot of the populace, which is interesting into itself, but it is it doesn't help your physical media numbers. I mean, Mutiny is doing okay with physical media still. We've got 3 Walmart releases coming up in the next 4 months. And one of those also has Best Buy as for exclusive for Blu-ray, because it's a horror movie. And we know how horror likes their physical media. But the only reason that we're able to do that is that we have an output partnership with I can say the name, with Mill Creek. And if we didn't have that, we would not be doing those wide releases there, because the returns are terrible. And if you make one wrong move on that, it can bankrupt you.
Well, that was going to say, I've talked about this a lot in my course, and I think even in my book, that the Walmart idea, the myth of a Walmart release or a Best Buy release is that, like, oh my God, they just bought, you know, I just sold 3,000 units. But they get to return anything that doesn't sell, right? And that could really hurt a distribution.
It's not even that they buy them and then you might return them. It's that they consign them. Oh. So you have to pay to replicate sometimes 20,000 units, and that's on you until they sell there, and that is brutal.
So as a distributor, why why do that? So like, let's say Walmart, let's say my film On the Corner of Ego and Desire. So let's say I had a Walmart deal and Walmart, and I'm going through Mutiny, your distribution company, and they go, look, Walmart wants 20,000 units. They really think it's going to sell because it's Sundance and a lot of people are going to go to buy this Blu-ray at Walmart because it's a Sundance time and all this kind of stuff. And you incur the cost because the filmmaker's not generally incurring that cost, or am I wrong on that?
We charge it as an again, we deal through Mill Creek, so we don't actually have to bear that cost. That's part of why we deal with Mill Creek on this. Mm-hmm. But they also take a huge slice of the pie for taking on that risk. And
right.
Yeah,
so that makes sense. So then they take the cost. Let's say they buy 20,000 or they replicate 20,000 of the movie. If 15 DVDs are sold and the rest of them are just like, sorry, we can't use them, and they return them, then you and Mill Creek have to eat that cost, right?
Yes and no. One of the other things about dealing with Mill Creek is extremely established in this. They've got, I think, over 18,000 titles that they've released. So that having that
weight behind them,
it does help a lot, which also means that the unsold discs for them do go to places like Dollar General or Big Lots or anything like that. So you don't. You still lose a little bit per unit, but instead of losing like $1.25, you're losing 25 cents, which makes all the difference in the world when you're dealing in numbers that big.
A nickel's a lot of money at that point. Every nickel you can save is good. Right, because Big Lots will buy 5,000 units at $1 a piece, and then they'll sell it for $3.99 or $2.99 in their stores.
Something like that, yeah. So that's how that's part of how they're able to cut risk. And that's the only way that this model makes sense right now. And frankly, if it were just us, we wouldn't do it. We would we deliver to Redbox on our own, and
But that's a straight up buyout, though, right? Like they buy.
Well, that's just straight up buyout, and you only have to replicate discs, which gets
no covers.
Way better.
You need spindles.
Exactly. And we also, when we're not dealing with Mill Creek, which is somewhat rare, we can also deliver to some of the smaller chains like Midwest Tape and Family Video and places like that.
Family Video just shut down, though, didn't they?
Did they? I am embarrassed. I missed that.
I saw an article that came out, Family Video they're shutting their stores, which is sad.
Yeah, I know. We were dealing with Family Video, and I knew they had shut down in Canada. I didn't realize that they'd shut down in the US too, but that makes sense. It doesn't seem like a safe time. Yeah.
They had a video store chain that was still working. Like, that's amazing.
Yes. I agree. This is actually as I'm hearing about it, and I'm a little sad. But
sorry, I didn't mean to break the news on air, sir. I just saw it fly by. I was like, oh, Family Video. No, that was the last hope. But there's still that last Blockbuster. Don't forget, there's that last Blockbuster you can still sell one or two units to.
Is that in Washington or Alaska?
No, Alaska's shut down. It's the one in Washington, I think. Yeah, the Alaska one shut down because that was the one that John Oliver sent the cod piece from Russell Crowe's cod piece from Cinderella Man as a way to drive people into the store and save it. And it didn't work. So there is one more Blockbuster left in the United States that's still alive. And it's now become a tourist attraction. It's just, you can actually Airbnb there, by the way. You can sleep over and sleep in. Like, I would absolutely sleep in a Blockbuster overnight.
You are not alone. I would do that too.
So they're figuring it out. They're figuring out what to do because it's obviously the rentals is not the biggest thing. So they're trying to build up other. And I'm going to have the director of the movie on soon. They directed the documentary on called The Last Blockbuster, which is doing really well as well. So I wanted everyone listening to understand the physical media gambit. Mm-hmm. It's still there, but it's a little weird, to say the least.
Yeah, and I mean, the big reason we do it and the big reason that we still seek out these deals is just that having that physical presence does have an impact on your VOD sales as well. Just the fact that people going to the store, if they see it on an end cap, even if they don't buy it there, which is generally what we ideally want them to do, they're more likely to click through and buy it if they happen to see it when they're browsing movies on iTunes or Amazon or wherever else. So that's why we keep pushing that, even though it comes out at better than a wash, but not significantly better than a wash. When we're talking about all the money that is a potential between all of the returns, Mill Creek's cut and the other things there, I am not, it's not as much money as you think it is. Like I,
so you were saying you still work with Redbox. How robust is Redbox's business model at this point? Are they still like growing? And I mean, I still see their kiosks everywhere, and I think they're the only guys who figured out how to do physical media properly, because there's just no overhead. Like it's barely any overhead. So that's why they're able to do, and it's, no, there's no employees. there's nothing. It's just a machine. So how robust is it, and how are the sales going to them?
So we had a Redbox, it's not exactly a Redbox exclusive, but it's a Redbox early release that happened earlier this month. And this was a small film with hardly, with no extremely notable cast in it, but it had, the first week it was out, it did, the first day it was out, it was number 4 at Redbox nationwide and number one in horror for the entire week. And then nationwide on the rental charts, the first week it was number 12, which is
huge.
Yeah. And that's just Redbox. So that is something that, in that film is I Am Lisa, because that's already out. I can say that. But it will be going to one of these other things later. And thanks to how well it did on Redbox, we've actually been able to get some international traction with it too. So it is.
What is a typical deal? Like, what is a typical buy on a Redbox deal? Like 5,000 units, 3,000 units, 1,000 units?
35,000.
35,000 units.
Yes, is the full buy.
Is that a full buy? Do they do partial buys or?
They will do, the least I've seen is a half buy. And that is 17.5 to 20, somewhere in that range. They also do double buys. So that's.
Oh, to have extra copies.
To have extra copies, because they have about 40,000 kiosks in the country. So.
Wow, that 40,000 kiosks. No wonder. So they have to fill those kiosks. Even so, in, and if you're buying, and if you're doing, you're replicating, so you're doing all the replication, but they're by, if you're replicating 20 to 35,000 DVDs, right? Or Blu-rays, or does it matter?
Yeah, DVDs. They have Blu-rays from us. I don't know if they actually do offhand.
So if it's, let's say 30,000, 35,000 DVDs, I'm assuming you get those for 75 cents, 50 cents.
It's more like when you're dealing in that volume, it's more like anywhere between 17 and 25 cents a disc.
And then buying them out. I don't know if you could tell me, Alex, I can't tell you that number, but what is a general, like, is there a ratio? Give me like a, just because I'm just curious. Maybe I'll ask you off air, but I'm just curious.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that number publicly.
Okay.
So I would be, I don't know, then
don't say that number publicly, but you can still see that it's a profitable, there's some profit.
Oh, it's very profitable.
It's a profitable place, and it's a buy. So if you could get a Redbox deal as an independent filmmaker, you're in a good place.
Oh yeah, it's a lot harder right now than it used to be. They are also feeling a bit of the crunch too. They used to buy about 4 times as many titles a month as they do now. So that can be difficult. But we seem to be doing decently well with it. So, I would take. Redbox deals are among the most profitable domestic distribution deals that exist right now. So
I would imagine, because God knows Amazon isn't. I want to put something to rest here, and I want someone like yourself to say it publicly on air with me. TVOD is dead for independent filmmakers unless you can drive traffic to the platform that you're doing the transactional to, and traffic of customers who are willing to purchase or rent your film. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. However, if you can drive enough people there to buy your movie to actually get picked up in the algorithm, you can get spillover sales from it. It's just, but you have to do those upfront numbers for it to work at all.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. With iTunes and Amazon and all those. Yeah. If you can get into the top 100, and then if you get into the top 50, and then if you can get in the top 10 of a category, not even the top 10 of all of iTunes, then the algorithm will pick you up and kind of give you a little bit more of a boost. But that's not easy.
No, it's not. Not at all.
And most filmmakers don't have that sophistication in audience or targeting or marketing or the research. Like, it's a rarity to find filmmakers that have an audience and the kind of movie that hits, and you know, it's rare. Mm-hmm. From my experience, just doing what I do all these years, I don't see it very often. Does it happen? Yes, but someone won the lottery the other day, so you know, it happens. But it wasn't me. I didn't win the $1 billion, so if anybody was just wondering, I'm sure you didn't. You probably wouldn't be on this call, sir, if you would have won.
I'd be buying my own private Cayman Island and just retiring. But
I'm out. I would say, I'm out, bitches, and just drop the mic and just run. because a lot of filmmakers still think the TVOD is an option, and they spent all this money on aggregators getting their films up on iTunes and Amazon and Google Play and, God forbid, Fandango and PlayStation and Xbox, which, I mean, it's so rare to generate revenue there unless it's a specific kind of title, but you really need to drive an audience. Do you agree? Mm-hmm.
Yes. The two that I've seen the best with from more of a producer's rep place, because we haven't really started our VOD launches besides Amazon at Mutiny yet, but I've seen a lot of back-end reporting from my time as a producer's rep. I was surprised. Second to Amazon, YouTube and Fandango were often towards the top for the films that were going out through these aggregators. iTunes was hit or miss.
Oh, no. Amazon, iTunes is not. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I heard from somebody I've worked with a couple times that apparently even for distributors who get much cheaper aggregation rates than standard filmmakers do, a lot of times when you aggregate to iTunes, I think it's something like 8 and 10 don't even make their aggregation feedback, which is atrocious, really.
Only 8 of 10? I would think it would be in line 0.5 out of 10. I mean, it's like, yeah. That's why I always tell people, like, okay, should I spend $2,000 to get my film up on Amazon, iTunes, and Google Play? I'm like, do you think your movie is going to make $2,000 in transactional in all of those platforms in the next 30 to 90 days? If you say yes, go for it. If you say no, why in God's green earth? I would spend that money, print DVDs and sell them out of the back of your truck.
Yeah.
Like, go door to door, go to flea markets. I mean, you're going to make more money. You're going to make more money doing that.
You might. Well, you're right. I mean, like, it's ridiculous how hard it is to actually make enough to move the needle enough that you can make any significant money from any single platform, which is why Amazon is just kind of the default, because it doesn't cost anything to get you up there.
But the thing is that with Amazon, it doesn't cost anything to get up there. And also, and everyone listening, I want you to understand too that the reason why you want to have your film up on an Amazon or an iTunes is because people feel comfortable. All they have to do is click a button. Their information, the credit card information is there. That's why I always go against Vimeo or Gumroad or those kind of platforms for films, because you're like, you're asking someone to put their credit card in. There's too many layers of entry, you know, blocking the entry to like give you a reason not to do it. But with Amazon, it's a click. iTunes, it's a click. Even Google, if you're, it's a click. YouTube is a click. It all depends on where you feel comfortable. It makes sense to put it on those platforms, but if you can't drive traffic, man, it's useless. But with Amazon specifically, you know, I want you to tell people why they're paying everybody. It's only a penny now for the work. Like, you know, it's a penny per hour streamed. And that's, I think from my understanding, is like the 50% point. Like if you hit like a certain point in the algorithm or the engagement, if you're under 50%, it's a penny. If you go 50 to 60, it's like 2 pennies. Like to get like the magical 11 or 12 cents, you gotta be like essentially Avengers.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah. And you've got to be driving so much actually engaged traffic to watch your movie that most filmmakers will never realize anything more than the cent per hour mark. Specifically when I said Amazon, though, I was actually talking about Amazon on TVOD. If you're doing transactional through Amazon, that almost always makes sense for a window. Sure. For FBOD, there's more you could talk about. But the biggest thing you can do to help yourself on Amazon, either for transactional or SVOD, is get all of your friends to watch and or buy the content as close to release time as possible, and actually watch it through. Even if they've already bought it or seen it somewhere else, or like
play in the background somewhere,
personal screening, just leave it somewhere while you do something else. Let it play there. That will actually help you rise through those rankings at least a little bit. I mean, again, unless you have that kind of Avengers money, it's going to be really hard to get to the point that you're making anything really, really good in terms of money. I don't think it's ever going to – yeah.
Would you recommend if someone had $1,000 for marketing, do you recommend calling all of your friends, everybody, and go buy the movie, watch it all the way through, send me proof that you purchased it and watched it all the way through, leave a review, and I will refund your money? So that way there's absolute engagement. You're paying for the engagement, and that way at least it kind of boosts it up a bit. I'm not even sure if $1,000 will even blink it, make a blink of it, but it might do something to get it into the algorithm.
If it did, if that happened over your launch weekend, that might move the needle a bit, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say that Amazon might well know that it's you doing that if that happens.
But if it's with different accounts, though, it's different people's accounts, different all around the country.
I mean, I hope that is – yes, that is true. But I don't know – so we've actually had several of our filmmakers who were trying to rate their own movie and also get their friends to rate their own movie that actually had their – they were no longer able to do ratings for that title at all. And that is a thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And I believe what you're talking about here, Alex, might actually be against the TOS on Amazon, but who actually
does?
I'm just trying
to hack. Yeah. I'm just trying to hack the system, sir. So yeah. I'm not sure if it's legal, not legal. According to Amazon, I'm just trying to help a filmmaker. But hey,
I completely agree. I would not be
I would never do anything like that.
I would never do or advise anything such as that.
Never do anything like that, sir. That would be wrong. But there are people out there that might, and we're just floating a balloon. Anyway. I wanted to ask you, there's been a big hoo-ha-ha about Warner Brothers and HBO Max's new release strategy. It is split Hollywood down the middle. I'd love to hear what you think about what they're doing, and how do you think it's going to affect things moving forward? And for everyone listening, if you don't know what Warner Brothers has done, they're releasing all of their theatrical big movies and in the theaters and on HBO Max at the same time, and you don't need to pay any more on HBO Max. It's included. So Wonder Woman was the first big test of that. Then every month, you know, I think Godzilla versus Kong, The Matrix, and I don't know about Dune. I think they're fighting Dune. There's so many of these movies that are coming out like this. What do you think is going to happen?
I think theaters have been in trouble for a bit, and I think that especially with COVID, we're going to see a massive change in that infrastructure coming very, very soon. Several of the big chains might not come back at all, which means that studios have to experiment and try new things here. From a consumer perspective, I think that removing the barrier for people who are worried about the coronavirus to see your content and legitimately worried about it, I think it's the smart play from a humanitarian perspective. And I think that there is going to be goodwill that's generated from that. And I think the people who are really, really, really into your IP are still going to go out to the theater.
I'm going to go. I want to see a Marvel movie in theaters. I want to see Bond in the theaters. Like, I don't want to see it at home only. I don't want to see Top Gun at home. I don't want to see the new Top Gun. I don't want to. I mean, I will, but I'm also not going to risk my health or my family's health to go see a movie. That's me personally. I know there's others that don't feel that way. And I also live in Los Angeles, which is the epicenter as of this recording. So it's a little bit, you know, maybe some other places in the country, in the middle of Wyoming somewhere, it's not that big of a deal. But where I'm living, it's a little bit more of a risk. But it's very interesting how the mindset is changing, because now people are going to almost expect it. It's going to be like you're changing everyone's mind or changing everyone's model of how they consume the content. Mm-hmm. Now, you got to tell me, like, in a year or two, the studios are going to try to change it back. It's going to be tough. And you were saying the theaters were in trouble. If for the last 10 years, it's been going on a steady decline, slowly. Mm-hmm. If you pull Marvel out of the theatrical experience, theaters would have never survived.
Look at the numbers.
Without Marvel movies, specifically Marvel movies, which is they released, I don't know, 20 films, they are responsible for, I don't know what, 35, 40% of the box office over the last decade. It's insanity. And if you pull out Disney total, then they're responsible for 60%, 65% of all box office. So it wasn't going in a good direction in the first place. And for generations like you and me, we grew up with theaters. We grew up going to the big screen. You know, my kids, they like the movie theater, but they're just as happy watching it at home. Mm-hmm. And it's sad, but it's just the way people – I mean, I don't want to watch – Top Gun on my iPhone. That's wrong.
I agree. I don't even think my big TV with my 7.1 surround sound is adequate for Top Gun, frankly.
You need a screen. I need like a personal, like Quentin Tarantino screening room to enjoy, like, you know, a real projector, a real screening room to be able to enjoy something like that at home. And I'm not rolling that deep just yet. So I can't afford that at the moment. Soon, but not just yet. But it's really interesting to see how our business is just changing. And whatever happens at the top, which is at the studio level, it is going to trickle down to you guys, to the you know, B and C and smaller distributors. Mm-hmm. Because before, theatrical was a tough sell for independent films, period. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Before COVID.
Okay. I mean,
you did some theatricals.
We did four last year. And that's a, and I mean, we did them specifically for, press. That was really it, because if you actually have any degree of press, any degree of a screening in a local market, you can generally get it reviewed, which helps it get discovered online because they link back and it's all about SEO at that point. We are still looking at doing a couple this year, but pretty much everything we're doing now is geared more towards virtual cinema, because a lot of times it will actually help to soothe that need and there's not the health risk involved. There are a couple times we're looking at actually doing a physical one because of the title, one we just closed today that I don't want to say the name of yet, but we're actually doing a full day and date with it. But we're not going to be releasing it for free anywhere on that day and date. It's going to be theaters, virtual cinema, and some other platforms with the same day as theaters. And because
can you explain to everybody what virtual cinema is?
So virtual cinema can mean a couple of different things, but in general, it's a partnership with a theater chain that enables you, that is essentially just premium video on demand. But because it's partnered with a theater chain, you can report it as box office to places like The Numbers and Box Office Mojo. And that starts to make a difference for international sales and other things. And that's part of why we've been using this model. The other thing from us is the virtual cinema model we use when we're partnering with local independent theaters, as opposed to a big chain like Longley or Alamo.
AMC or something like that, yeah.
Yeah. When, they have their own platforms, but when you're partnering with the local guys, we do it through Vimeo OTT, and we just create a separate product that is film name at theaternamecom at theater name, and we give the theater 50% of the take for sending it out, and we keep the rest, but we also capture the emails for that exact sort of consumer type. So if we're selling horror movies in to a theater in Kansas, all of a sudden we have a list of horror consumers in Kansas, which helps
a lot. So huge.
Yeah.
That's interesting. See, it's fascinating to see how, you know, the smart distributors are trying to, you got to maneuver, you've got to do something, you can't just sit around and wait for DVD sales from Walmart. It's mm-hmm. a constant change, and that's why I wanted to have you on, because I wanted to see what you were doing and what, you know, you definitely got your nose to the grindstone on what's going on. You got your hand on the pulse of what's going on, like, daily. And the thing is changing daily. Like, it's almost weekly or monthly. There's something new happening, you know, something else is going to happen, or there's a new model, or there's a new thing. Like, you know, if I would have told you last year drive-ins were going to be a thing, you would have laughed in my face. But drive-ins have become, I think, one of the biggest revenue generators right now, right?
I will say that I've always loved drive-ins, mm-hmm. but after the pandemic goes away, I don't think they're going to stick around.
They were nostalgic to begin with. They're like nostalgic, you know, squared, because theaters are nostalgic. And then like drive-in theaters are even more nostalgic. I mean, it's like I really want to go to a video store, but I only want to rent VHS. Like, okay, you're going to multiple levels of nostalgia here, sir. I only watch beta tapes, like Betamax. That's the only thing I rent is Betamax. So,
hey, Laserdisc, man. Don't forget about Laserdisc.
Hey, I just sold my Laserdisc collection and I'm still kind of sad about it. It was sitting there. I had all my Criterions and I had my Laserdisc player from high school that still worked. And I just like, I'm never going to watch this. Why? Let me just, and I sold it for a few hundred bucks to a collector. And it must have been easily like $2,000-$3,000 for the Laserdiscs back in the day retail. And, you know, so if I got anything for it, I was happy. Now, another big question I get asked all the time is, how relevant are film festivals anymore to the distribution model or marketing or things like that? My feeling has always been that they've been going down. It's not, I think film festivals are still riding high off the 90s. The relevance of film festivals in the 90s, which was the Sundance movement, and that's when film festivals became kind of rock stars. Because before the 90s, there's no film festivals in the 80s that mattered. I mean, Cannes, obviously, in Berlin, and some of the bigger, older, you know, more established film festivals, but there wasn't like 5,000 film festivals in the US back then. And filmmakers still have that mentality that film festivals are where I'm going to get found by a distributor. You're a distributor. Do you look for film festivals? Do you look at, I mean, obviously you probably do look at film festivals, but is it, if I won Best Picture at Moose Jaw International Film Festival, which I don't know that's a real festival. If I won that festival, I won Best Picture at the Moose Jaw International Film Festival, I could put those laurels. Do you give a crap? Does it put anything to the bottom line?
It doesn't really put anything to the bottom line, no. Unless you're doing the top, let's say, 20 film fests in the world, it doesn't really matter that much to a distributor. I actually wrote a blog on this about my site, specifically about why you won't get distribution from your festival run. I think it's almost exactly that title, which is more there, but the gist of it is what you're covering. There are too many festivals, there are too many films being made, and distributors don't have the time to track all of them. Now, to largely reverse what I just said, Mutiny actually has a invitation-only festival first look program. Mm-hmm. So we'll partner with a festival, and if the filmmaker opts in, we'll review their movie and we'll make a what we think to be a fair offer for it. And we do that because part of this game, being successful as a distributor, is about finding the best content as early as you can. Because anything that's really in demand, there's going to be competition for. There will be multiple offers for. Pretty much everything I chase, somebody else has an offer in on as well. And most of the time I have to not so subtly say why we're better than these other people.
You just send them over to the Protect Yourself from Predatory Film Distributors Facebook group and go do a search for their name on that group and let me know what you find.
Yeah, no, I haven't actually done that yet, but I probably will.
You should definitely do that, sir. It's an easy. You don't have to say. You don't have to be the bad guy. I'm like, no, let's just go look. You know, there's a that other big guy who loves to buy independent films who will remain nameless. Oh, that guy. Oh, just go over and do a search for them in that group and see how that worked out for a lot of the people.
That's a good call.
I'm here to help. So, I'm here to help, Ben. I'm here to help.
But yeah, I mean, so on that same level, we try to be ethical about that because most of the time when you get a distribution offer from a festival, you should run. They're really bad. They do happen. Are you familiar with this?
I've heard of it, vaguely heard of it, but it's just such an obscure, weird thing. Like the only festival that I know of that has a real release situation is Sundance. Like they will pick up a film and they will release it through their banner and they, you know, Sundance TV. And I know filmmakers who've gone down that road. But that's kind of like a lottery ticket. It's like A24 picking up your film. Like they pick up 12 movies a year or 13 movies a year. Like it's very selective.
Yeah. So the ones that I've seen, and I ran into this a fair amount as a ref, it's almost like they're white labeling distributor. I think some of them actually at the time were just white labeling distributor, which, and then taking, you still pay those fees, and they also take something, so an absurd amount of the take on it. So
that's a new one. It doesn't surprise me, but I hadn't heard that specific situation. So for everyone listening, who is not familiar with what the words that are coming out of Ben's mouth, it's basically this. A film festival will say, hey, we're Film Festival X, and we'll distribute your movie under our banner, Film Distribution X Company. And all they'll do is call up Distributor or a film aggregator. And if you don't know who Distributor is, just do a search for Distributor on Google and you'll find a lot about them and probably see my face there. Then they'll charge you what they're going to get charged to put their films up on iTunes, Amazon, and whatever. And for the pleasure of that, they'll also take 35% or 25% or something like that.
Yeah.
That's so abusive. It's not even funny.
No. That is very much what happens, and I've seen those sorts of things. I can't confirm that it was a full white label of that, but given what they were offering and given how long I've been in this game, it looked a hell of a lot like that's what they were doing. Am I allowed to swear on your podcast, Alex?
Yeah, generally, I don't like it, but if you want to throw a couple F-bombs in, I'll allow it.
Yeah, so that is a, I will try to, refrain from George Carlin's, most famous bit.
yes.
But, so yeah, that is, so the reason we do that and the film festivals we target are the sort that, attract the content that our biggest domestic buyers are looking for. Like, we generally know what Showtime's looking for because we're really close with them. We know what Stars is looking for the same reason. And same for Redbox, same for all of these. So in order to help us better find this content so that we can sift through and get the ones that we know we can really do well with and make sure the filmmaker does well out of as well, mm-hmm. It just allows us to find those people more quickly by having those relationships with the festivals.
So there's like some genre festivals, like some horror festivals or things like that, because there's, you know, that's an easier sell for you with your distribution model, mm-hmm. connections and things like that. You can sell that fairly easily. But if I have a period drama with no stars in it, it's going to be a little bit difficult to sell.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
to say
depends
the least.
On which period. Like, if you were able to make, let's say, a Roman epic for $10,000 and it doesn't look like total crap, yeah, I'm pretty sure I could sell that.
Oh no, you could sell that. Yeah, I'm saying, okay, let's seventies inside an apartment melodrama, no stars, decent production. Decent production, mm-hmm. solid production, acting solid. Let's just say writing, acting, and production, direction, all solid. Not like Scorsese 1976, but solid. Mm-hmm. You're not going to sell that.
No, it's going to be really difficult. Yeah, it's a I have had to have more conversations about why dramas are hard to sell than I care to on places like.
I know. I'm doing my best to preach the word, man. I've been yelling at filmmakers. I'm like, don't do a drama with a movie star is hard to sell. It's just hard. It's hard. unless it's niche. If you have a niche.
Yes.
If you have a niche, that's a different conversation. But you're talking like a generic, you know, family drama. No.
Define family.
Exactly. So, because the family could be a niche. It could be, you know, it could be dealing with autism. That's a niche. Mm-hmm. Dealing with, you know, but if and we don't want to get into the weeds on this, but generally speaking, if it's just a general drama about a family, you know, just doing family stuff in the 70s. It's not going to sell. It's going to be real. It's going to be tough. And I've seen those movies. I've seen $250,000 dramas with no stars in it. And they come to me and they go, what do you think we could do with this? And I'm like, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, man, but it's going to be a rough sell. Like, yeah. And like, oh, we got this deal from this big distributor. I'm like, you're probably never going to see a dime.
Yes, that's.
It's sad, but it's true. It's sad. It's sad, but it's true. What do you feel? What are you getting for AVOD right now? Like, are you getting? Is AVOD turning into a real revenue stream for independent films? Because I know AVOD is making a lot of money for studios and established movies, but for in your world, from independent films, how is it doing?
Depends a bit on which genre and which niche you're talking about. Urban films are doing extremely well, be they independent or big studio pictures on AVOD. You just kind of have, but in general, I'd say that AVOD is probably going to be the biggest sector of growth in the industry in the next at least a year. There was just something that I think I actually saw it in one of your groups, that was Tubi dropping their numbers, and they've seen just gargantuan growth in this. And I don't think that growth is really going to go away. Sure, it was aided by the pandemic, and it might go down a little bit after this, but I don't think it's going to really, I don't think it's going to completely retract. And I think people are going to be, I think AVOD for everyone under 35 is going to be the nail in the coffin for traditional cable. Is really where it's
going. Yeah, yeah, I agree with you 100%. But the funny thing is, I find about AVOD is like the advertisers are advertising to people who can't even afford a subscription a lot of times. So is that model make sense, or is it just more brand awareness? Because I'm not saying that all people who watch AVOD can't afford that. I'm not saying that. But generally speaking, people who do consume AVOD are people who are not purchasing or don't have Disney Plus, HBO, Netflix, and Hulu, and some other platforms, or has cable in general. So if I'm advertising a product on AVOD that is, you know, higher priced, does that make sense? So that's a much deeper question that I don't think you and I have above our pay grade. But
more than likely, but I would put one at least thought process on that. Some of the biggest ad spenders are companies like Coca-Cola.
Yeah, and of course.
People can afford a Coke. It's a and other sorts of brands that are at a similar price point to that. So I think that AVOD, I think in if TV, and they spend tons of money on TV right now, if they're looking to access the key demographic and they're all moving to AVOD, I think they're going to start spending money on AVOD.
Yeah, I know the Super Bowl this year is there. There's a lot of people who are not going to advertise, like Budweiser. For the first time in 38 years, is not going to advertise on the Super Bowl.
That's definitely a sign of the times.
That says, and it's beer.
Yeah,
beer. I doubt that beer has taken a hit.
Is it beer though?
The views of our guests do not necessarily represent the views of the host or the show. No, but you know what I mean. It's alcohol. That we can agree upon. It is alcohol. So I doubt that beer is taking a big hit during this time. I'm assuming this. I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'm assuming beer and alcohol sales have probably gone up a bit because of what's going on in the world, which is not a good thing. But why wouldn't they be advertising there? Could you get for that $5.5 million that you're gonna have for that 1 30-second spot if you threw $5.5 million into an AVOD sequence? Like,
oh, how much? God, you get so many impressions. I can't imagine. Ooh.
I mean, so think about that. Like, if I'm gonna spend $5.5 million for 30 seconds, mind you, you're gonna have 100 million eyeballs on it, or you can have eyeball after eyeball after eyeball for probably months for that price on a Tubi and on a Pluto and those kind of places. It's pretty insane.
I like, if you use YouTube as an example, it's actually pretty decent on this. I think it's something like 10 cent per full video view on YouTube. 10 cent times, like, what, that's 50 million easily. Right there.
Views.
That's actual views. That's not counting the skip after 6 seconds. So I imagine they're going to get a lot of eyeballs.
I think the whole world is changing so fast and so rapidly that it's just difficult to keep up. And I think independent filmmakers are just. I just want everyone listening to understand we are not in the 90s anymore. We're not in the early 2000s. We're not even a year ago. We are in a completely different world, and it's changing so rapidly that by the time I know that some people started their movie before COVID with one business model, and after it, they're just like, oh my God, that's how fast things are changing. And I do you think, and I truly believe this is going to happen, but I would love to hear your thoughts. Amazon, Netflix, Apple, Facebook, someone is going to buy not only some smaller studios, because MGM is up for sale now. They're,
oh, yeah.
That library. And I saw that coming. And someone's mm-hmm. – if Apple doesn't buy MGM, I don't even – why wouldn't you?
I don't
understand why you wouldn't buy MGM at this point. Their library is massive. But they're going to buy out – Sony's probably going to go next. Not the TV, but the theatrical side, because it's been hurting for years. Lionsgate is Prime as well. That's another potential acquisition. So those acquisitions, but then also, would Netflix or a company like Netflix purchase Regal or AMC and do some sort of mixture? I always said, and I'm not sure it might be Netflix, but I said if someone like Disney bought AMC, that makes a lot of sense, because now there's a Disney store in every single theater, and they can have Disney themed restaurants inside. Like, it becomes a completely different business model, because now they're not, it's not even about sharing money with the revenue of the movies, it's their movies. It's like, does that make sense?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, no, I think that from Disney's perspective, I can see that entirely. And that's assuming that we have just stopped caring about antitrust laws, which we have. So that's,
yeah, it's,
that's
gone. Yeah, that's gone. Yeah, that whole antitrust thing is gone.
But I think it makes a lot of sense for Disney with someplace like AMC. I'm not 100% convinced that Regal is as hurting as AMC is.
But the AMC is just bigger. They're just a much bigger beast.
Yeah. And they also kind of overexpanded for a bit there. So that was the thing. And Regal was not as victim to that. So they have a bit, they can weather more of a shock than AMC could. So I think Disney and AMC would make a lot of sense. I think that you're right on Apple and MGM. I haven't looked at the subscription numbers for Apple TV Plus lately, but I can't imagine they're doing that well on a lot of that. Yeah.
Because they're not taking it seriously yet. I don't care what they say. They're not taking it seriously. This is kind of like Apple, for them, it's a line item. It's nothing. Like, they're like, oh, we spent $5 billion on content. That's nothing. For Apple, that's like literally, it's like craft services on an independent film. Like, it doesn't mean anything to them. But if they're serious and they want to, I think the second that Apple really becomes, they say, you know what, we want to buy Netflix. Then when they're serious, I don't know when they're going to be serious, but I think someone's going to do that.
Yeah, and I think that I was pretty convinced that they were going to buy Netflix a few years ago, but I think the last time I was on this podcast, I was also pretty convinced of it.
You said the same thing there, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm less convinced of it now. They've actually done pretty well out of the pandemic, and they're in less of a dire financial strait than they were. But I do think that in order for Apple TV Plus to actually gain any major traction in the marketplace, you're right, they need to start buying up libraries. They need to look at, if they take over MGM's library, they can afford to, and put it, a lot of it is exclusive on Apple TV Plus overnight.
It's massive.
The entire James Bond collection overnight. That's good. That you can run an ad campaign on that easily, and
just on that, and they have multiple Rocky, like, there's just so much stuff that they have that they own, and then Lionsgate's another catalog, massive, and then, you know, they drop down $5-7 billion on it. I we're talking about it like you and I rolled like that, but we don't. But for companies that size, it's not that big of a purchase. So it's just all about a bigger conversation. So let's talk about why you decided to jump from a producer's rep to a distributor. Like, what? Because I've only known you as a producer's rep all these years, and then all of a sudden you told me that you have a distribution company. So what made you make the jump?
A lot of sales agents and distributors are shifty as hell. And
stop it. Stop it.
I know. How dare I? But the and even as a producer's rep, I was at much better. Like, part of the issue is that there's a massive discrepancy in information for filmmakers versus a sales agent. Having a producer's rep doesn't fully alleviate that, but helps a lot in alleviating that. And especially if the producer's rep is working closely with your lawyer. But the but even then, a contract is only as good as the people who wrote it. So if you're dealing with a bad, disreputable sales agent or distributor, even if you get the best contract in the world, it's not going to matter that much.
They don't pay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I had that one filmmaker, unfortunately, he's diagnosed with terminal cancer, who had a contract that said that we're going to pay you $100,000 MG. And he spent all his money getting the deliverables ready, sold his car because, oh, I got 100 G's coming. Then never got paid. Still, so it doesn't matter.
And that one's actually a pretty easy one to enforce because it's an actual MG as far as these go. It's not, I mean, I'm speaking comparably. It's obviously he's having trouble, and I don't remember if I actually heard that whole podcast, but it's much easier to chase down an MG or a license than it is to chase down royalty payments is the big part that I'm going for there. And most independent films just don't get an MG or a license for it. And if you're in the producer's rep position of constantly having to pound sales agents and distributors for even just reports, not even money necessarily, just reports. I realized with how much of my time I was spending on, I realized that I'd really like to get more into direct distribution, and then the opportunity presented itself where some of my favorite people to work with found themselves without companies, so we made one ourselves. So,
and that makes
that's
that
makes work. Yeah.
So how do you guys do releases? How do you release during this insane time your films?
We take it a little bit on a case by case basis, but we always try to emphasize our. We always try to bring the things we do best to every release we have. And the things we do best are deep relationships to big pay TV providers and big physical media retailers, as well as publicity. We're really good at publicity. We've only been around since June, which as of this recording is about 7 months ago. And we've already been covered in Rolling Stone, the New York Times, LA Times, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The Wrap. I really could, Miss Magazine, I could go on for a long time on this. And part of what we bring to the table is a full service PR firm with that actually gives you attention, and we don't charge pitch fees. We charge a percentage of press gotten, and it's capped at a frankly ridiculously low number. And then we are also really, really good at bridge booking, and because we're really good at bridge booking, and bridge booking is essentially short, like we know most of the independent theaters in the country, and we call them up a couple weeks before the actual booking is to start. We secure the big markets, New York and LA, further out. But after that, we start trying to get stuff closer because they find these theaters sometimes find themselves with holes in their schedule. So we just fill that hole. And it ends up meaning that we can do a 15-screen theatrical run.
Nice.
On essentially on, I think, without paying a single rental fee. I'll say that. I don't want to say exactly what the P&A spend is because that's separate. Mm-hmm. But we don't have to pay a single rental fee to the theater.
And that's built on relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's part of what we do. We don't do a theatrical for everyone. We did, like I said, we did four last year. And we're kind of putting a little bit of a hiatus on it because we don't necessarily feel right pushing theatrical when we ourselves wouldn't go to a theater. And there's just kind of a moral issue there.
Yeah, like you're a butcher, but you're vegan. Like it's a rough.
Yes, exactly.
It's a rough sell.
So that's why we do that. But even with that, we still do virtual cinema. We do. We work with Mill Creek to set a release date. Some days we will do. Some films will do an early Amazon release before we do a wider physical and VOD release. Mm-hmm. And then we do our absolute damnedest to get it picked up by one of the big boys in pay TV. Right. We've already got a film on Showtime. We have some others coming to some of the other people, but since they're not on there and they haven't made an announcement yet, I'm not going to say who they are. But for the right films, like this one I've alluded to a couple times that just closed today, some of the big theater chains still talk to us about getting a much wider release. And that is... and that's basically what we do for each film. And depending on what we negotiate for pay TV, when the window allows us, after the SVOD and pay TV window, we'll do AVOD. We've got a lot of contacts in that space too. But the big thing about Tubi is you need to upload 100 films at a time right now. And that's why you kind of need to go through somebody if you're going to do it. So,
gotcha. Yeah, you can't aggregate yourself onto Tubi.
Yeah.
Unless you have 100 films you've directed, and then that's a conversation.
That's not as easy as you might think it is. And I hope you don't think it's easy.
No, it's not. It's not at all, from what I understand. Now, the most important question I'd like to ask any distributor that I bring onto the show, how do you pay filmmakers?
So we are different in this, and this is something that kind of I wrote most of the Mutiny contract myself, and then our lawyer punched it up, and then I went back and rewrote some of the lawyer bits, and then we did that like three times. But the basically we tend not to pay minimum guarantees, just due to risk aversion and the fact that we're still a small young company, but we structure our contract in such a way that filmmakers are paid from the first deal. So that is we include a corridor that's equal to our commission in the first phase of the waterfall until we recoup. So that would be, let's just say 25% on commission. Right now, that's not always the case, but that would mean we take 25%. After the uncapped and other recoupable expenses, and like the uncapped recoupable expenses, which would be things like DVD replication, would be a uncapped.
Sure, because that's a sale. So you're only spending that money if money's coming in. So that makes sense.
Yes, and then there's something like that too. And also, we have a blanket E&O policy that we grant access to the filmmaker for, that we charge a single flat fee the first time we deliver something that requires it.
And that's probably cheaper than me going out and getting it myself.
Yes. Granted that this thing is still, it's significantly cheaper. I've looked into it. But the other thing I would say there is, in general, you might still want to get your own, because ours is tailored to protect us and the buyer more than you. But generally, so I would just say that for legal reasons. But but it means that you are not required to do that under some deals, which you would. Like pay TV, you always need that. So that's why we do it that way. And then the other level would be... So right, then it would be 25% to us, 25% to you, the filmmaker, and then the remaining 50% to our capped recoupable expenses, which as of right now are $10,000 to $15,000, depending on whether or not we do a theatrical with it.
And you're reporting all of those expenses and showing where you're spending money.
Yes, we are. And line item reporting even. So
shocking. Are you kidding me? Stop it. I literally just got off the phone with a filmmaker I was consulting about this, and they were like, "Hey, I got this deal. They want 40,000 expenses capped." And I'm like, "But we asked them, because we watched your course, Alex, and we asked them for, are you going to report?" And they're like, "No, we're not going to tell you what we're spending our money on." So I'm like, straight up, they're just like, "Yeah, we're not going to give you any reporting." Like that. Come on. And it's one of the larger ones. Let's just put it.
Shocking. Shocking, I say.
It's the larger one that we all know. And it's like Voldemort. We don't say the name.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I'm glad you do it. I'm glad you actually are showing reporting and things like that. So you seem to be a little bit more transparent than most distributors.
We actually were kind of founded on transparency. I don't think it's anywhere public, but it's on a lot of internal documents as a brand and core value. So
you should probably put it publicly. That probably is a good thing to do.
You probably should. I just have too many responsibilities.
Listen, man, it's been a pleasure, Ben, talking to you. Where can people find out more about you and your company and what you do?
So the best places to find out about us are mutinypictures.com. And in general, most of my content right now is through Medium, which is just ben@mutiny.medium.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fantastic. Ben, it's a pleasure to talk to you as always, sir. And next time we talk, the game will have changed again.
I'm sure. Wait, we're talking next week?
Yeah, exactly. But be well and stay safe, man. Thanks for everything you do. I want to thank Ben for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs, as I knew he would. Thanks again, Ben. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/449. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. I really need your help to get better and better rankings for that darn algorithm to pick up this amazing content and help as many filmmakers as possible. And guys, the next episode will be episode 450. And I promise you that this episode is going to be one of the most epic episodes I have ever released. I've been teasing you guys about who is going to be this mystery guest, but it is going to be a whopper, I promise you. The only hint I will give you is he was one of those 1990s lottery ticket winning filmmakers who took off and blew up after screening at Sundance. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to say anything else. You'll just have to wait till Thursday. Thank you guys again for listening so much. I love teasing you guys. This is great. I'm so excited about this episode. I can't even just contain myself. I want to tell you so badly. But don't worry. Thursday morning, you guys will know. Thanks again for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.